We have one final case on our calendar this morning, and that case is A221671, Donald Floyd Diebel Jr., petitioner, appellant, versus Haley Elizabeth Espeline, respondent. And this is a case where we did not receive a brief from respondent, and so appellant will be providing the only oral argument this morning. Counsel, you will have 15 minutes to present your argument. And of course, given that there is no oral argument from respondent, that will be the entirety of your time. There'll be nothing for you to rebut. I think I've seen you in the courtroom. You've heard me admonish the attorneys to please introduce yourself and identify the party you're representing, but I did it again. We are ready to go whenever you are.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Rosalyn Ordon, and I represent Donald Diebel, Jr., and he's the appellant in this matter, and he was the petitioner in the lower court marriage dissolution action. This is an appeal from the decree dissolving the marriage of the parties, and that was from October 11th of 2022. That decree followed 2 days of trial, and basically we're talking about a one-year marriage here, 2 days of trial on contested issues which dealt with the valuation of primarily two assets. The characterization of the property is either marital or non-marital, and then ultimately the division of those assets. And I'm emphasizing the fact this was a short-term marriage because the parties were married May 30, 2020. My client commenced a marriage dissolution in January of 2021, so 7 months later. There was a short reconciliation, so the case was deactivated. And then the parties permanently separated in April of 2021. So they were together less than a year. The process, the divorce process, was lengthy and resolved. It took approximately the same length of time to get through a divorce trial as the parties had been together. And now here we are in the appellate process, where it's also taken almost a year. So focus on the fact it's really a one-year marriage, even though legally they were married longer, and this process continues.
Ms. Nordane, can I ask you, with regard to that, it seems like obviously the main objection your client has as to the Meeker County property is the allocation between marital and non-marital.
Correct.
Which kind of goes to what you're talking about, perhaps. But one question I have, I didn't see it in the record, but maybe I missed it. The big issue seemed to be because the property was destroyed by fire, there's an insurance payoff that had a value, which I assume predominantly was the value of the pre-fire property, but also some personal property. But was there any evidence, presented to the court as to property values as between when your client first bought it as prior to marriage and I can't remember the year, 14 perhaps, 2014, right. And then when it had a fire in terms of the appreciation of it?
Sure.
Or was it simply a matter of tax statement, I know your client submitted, insurance payoff, et cetera?
First of all, there was no property to value as of the date of the divorce. So in other words, to do a valuation that would have been consistent with the date of valuation, the property was gone.
But what I mean is the insurance company obviously didn't appraisal of the loss, so they had to come up with a value. I guess what I'm getting at is let's assume that because it appreciated significantly, but if it did it other than just an average per year, there'd be evidence for a court to maybe assign some equity between marital and non-marital. But I didn't see that, so I'm assuming that was not presented.
Yeah, actually what was presented was that this was an insurance payoff that had actually existed on that policy from the date he bought the property, because he just took over the insurance that the sellers had. So whether or not that value based upon the insurance payment was legitimate, who knows, but that's what he received.
Okay. Really? So the seller on the contract for deed had the house insurance liability?
I'm sure it's in the transcript when he talked about how he just assumed the seller's actual policy. The sellers were insurance agents. So as he described it, they had everything overvalued on their insurance. So he didn't think anything of it, and he just kept the same policy in effect and had it actually with the sellers, and it is a significant amount of proceeds versus what he purchased it for. You're right, Your Honor. And so when it came to actually putting a value into the record, what we really were talking about was what was the value of what was left. And for that purpose, we had two things. We had a property tax value, and we had my client's testimony about the value. Bottom line is, we're not sure what the judicial officer used. One of our major complaints with this, Your Honor, is that the findings are all over the board. We have a balance sheet, which is attached to the judgment decree, that has entries that don't even tie into the findings. Okay. So when it comes to the Meeker property, there's several errors that we ask the court to consider because, you know, the basic facts of Meeker were not contested. You know, everyone agreed he owned it. Everyone agreed how many payments he had made. Where it came down to was two errors. One is treating all of the insurance proceeds as marital, even though he'd been paying on the premium all those years. And the other issues were, if all the insurance proceeds were marital, then what ultimately was supposed to be the percentage applied, and the court erred even on that in her own analysis. If what was paid toward the contract for deed balance and what had been paid by him during the marriage, she got the math wrong.
But when you say the judge used all of the insurance proceeds, I didn't quite read it that way, although I do see that the payoff of the contract was 100% considered marital.
Right.
And that's one of the points you're making. That's what you meant when you say.
Right.
Whereas then later the judge, the referee that was affirmed by the judge, used 49%.
Correct.
As marital.
Correct.
And that's the number. Would you agree that the law does not require a precise equality when it comes to differentiation, but why in this case do you think it's more than de minimis error by the court in terms of assigning 49%?
For two reasons. One is there is no way you can understand what she really did in arriving at that 49%. And secondly, she's completely disregarded that premarital contribution of the ongoing insurance premiums. Okay. So what happens here is, in a vacuum of just a few months, the respondent realizes a substantial gain in property that she never financially contributed to at all. And that's a huge error on the Meeker property, the conclusion of the 49%. The other errors are shown on the balance sheet. She used two numbers there. She used $110,000, I think, at one point. Didn't apply any percentage to that. Then went on to use a $60,000 value and applied a 49% value to that. There's no explanation of where did the 49% come from. You know, our position was it was a 9%. If you treat it the same way as the contribution of the payments, keep it at the 9% level. If you use her math, we get 39% would have been her calculation of the marital. So it's just the error is the findings don't support the conclusions, but the record also doesn't support the findings that are all over the board.
Well, would you agree, if we agreed with you, it would simply have to be remanded for further proceedings? In other words, you may not necessarily get what you want, but the court would decide how to proceed, whether to open the record, whether to, based on the record, make new findings or different findings.
And ultimately, I think that's what will happen. But then there's the legal issue of just the significance of the insurance payment and whether that should be regarded. I mean, there are specific findings where she says all of the insurance proceeds are marital, even though I don't think she applied it that way, but it's not explained.
Can I ask you?
And then she carries it over into personal property.
Can I ask you a question on the other property, Minnehaha property? One issue that appears was not raised to the district court, nor have you raised it in your brief, and of course we don't have a responsive brief, is that the house is owned by a non-party LLC.
Right.
And case law is quite clear that the court cannot order distribution, distribution of a non-party's property. And so separate from your other argument, I realize in terms of the gift and non-marital status, would you agree that that should be remanded to the court? And there would have to be, I'm assuming the parties didn't talk about what her ownership interest, although it looked like it was her soul, I couldn't quite tell. But you can't transfer the house itself. You can transfer one's shares in the LLC.
Right. The distinction would be that the LLC is an asset of the marriage. So the balance sheet, the proper way of dealing with it probably would have been to have the LLC valued by the value of the property it owned, okay? Because respondent is the sole owner of this LLC, but the party's married, and one of the things my client felt was he was protected because it was an LLC owned by his wife. And so it is a property that the court should have considered in terms of non-marital versus marital value with the same analysis as the actual building itself, the Minnehaha residence. So that's how I would treat it on remand. I mean, we're not saying that it should be awarded to my client, but it should be recognized as a marital property. And, you know, one of the issues we had here was that during the process itself, there was an agreement to sell that property, which wife did not do. She didn't cooperate in doing that. So we get a new judicial officer who says, oh, I'll give you another chance. Okay. And then we get down.
The main issue, though, your client raises, I understand it, to that how property, well, it's twofold, perhaps. Number one, disagrees with the court's finding and conclusion that it was a gift.
Right.
And number two, that the non-marital share should not be invaded in order to equitably reimburse him for his sweat equity, essentially.
Correct.
But my question to you is, we always defer to the district court in terms of credibility, and it looks like all that was laid out. Your client said no, it's part of investment, and et cetera, and she testified that no, it was a gift, and the court found her more credible. What can we do with that?
The court also has to have findings that make sense. And in this case, there are several ways of dealing with it. I think the biggest issue in my client's mind is through her analysis, she ended up with a zero value for the property because she found that there was an inability to actually meet the contract for deed that was coming due 3 months later. That is a real gamble, Your Honor, in that suddenly wife is sitting with an asset that she alone controls, and whether it's a zero value because she really does let the contract go, or did she manage to sell it, or is she still there? All of that's post-decree, so it's not in the record, but it still provides her with a potential windfall because she's in control of it.
By the way, I noticed that the contract vendor seller had a mortgage against the same property. Was there evidence? I didn't see it. Is that still a lien on that same property?
The idea was that the payment in full of the balloon by the parties here would take care of all debt against the property. So in effect, they were either planning to sell or buy the property. So it would have been relieved of all encumbrances.
Upon the payment of the balloon.
Correct. Which, again, was supposed to happen 3 months after the divorce. And so we get, I think that it is error for the judicial officer to find a zero value in this.
Well, this one of the exhibits, you notice a discrepancy. I'm looking under the attachment to the judge's order under Minnehaha property, and it's got $275 as a value, and then non-marital of $94,200. What do you know what that
Absolutely, I have no idea.
Thank you.
Yep. I mean, there was potentially over $100,000 in equity, and that's one of the reasons why the prior judicial officer had ordered the property sold. Parties agreed to it. Respondent never followed through, because it was a recognition that my client had put substantial funds into this property. And yes, it goes to the question of whether or not it's a gift. Well, the only way he was going to get any monies out, and respondent would get any monies out, was to follow through with the sale, which didn't happen. So basically, the court ignored all the possible legal angles of getting my client back his income that he had put into the property, and that's substantial money. But yeah, I refer you to the balance sheet. And the numbers don't add up. The numbers don't tie into the findings. You know, there's the issues of the personal property that we addressed in the brief. And just in general, the findings don't support the conclusions, and the findings don't follow the record. So it's our hope that the court will reverse and remand, and let us try to clean it up with the judicial officer. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your helpful argument this morning. The matter is now submitted to the court, and the that concludes our oral argument session this morning as well. The court now stands in recess. Thank you.